Welcome to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Barraff, and today I'm here having a conversation with Professor Amber Kim, who has a focus on urban education and culturally responsive and critical pedagogy. She's a coach and consultant committed to helping educators develop equity literacy and student-centered schools. She teaches at the University of Colorado in Denver, and thank you for being with me here today, Amber.
Hi, Arthur. Thanks for having me.
Amber, I wanted to get your perspective on how student-centered learning can improve outcomes for marginalized students. And on this podcast, we're defining student-centered learning as personalized learning, student-owned learning, competency-based learning, and anytime, anywhere learning. And I know a lot of your background is in the personalized learning, not so much using technology to personalize with one-to-one computing, but more giving students choice and voice in their education. Can you talk about how these methods have improved outcomes for students from marginalized communities?
Sure. If we take a look back at history a little bit to understand how standardized learning was hurting and targeting marginalized communities, that's where I think we start, which is when we realized that educational outcomes were horrible for marginalized students already. So students of color, students living in poverty, usually students at the intersection of being of color and living in poverty, we saw that their educations were not only segregated, but didn't provide any outcomes. They dropped out at higher rates, and they scored significantly lower on any tests. What happened was the standardization of education for those students, and it became extremely standardized through policy in the 80s and the 90s. And that's where we saw this focus, this hyper-focus on all kids receiving the exact same curriculum, supposed to be in the same place at the same time. And I think student-centered learning is about giving kids choice and voice back. So although we know that students were treated unfairly when we weren't completely standardized, and that was not okay for targeted communities, we also know that standardizing their education and giving them no choice and no voice is leading to outcomes that aren't closing the achievement gap either necessarily. And there's no joy in the classroom for students. So that's one way that student-centered learning starts to give back power and choice and voice to communities who are targeted and silenced.
So tell me a little bit more about how you define student-centered learning in your work.
In my work, we talk about student voice all the time. And the idea is that students, you don't give students voice, we make space for student voice. And to make space for student voice, you have to have opportunities in your classroom and in your school where students can talk about what they want to learn, how they want to learn, and how it's relevant to their lives. And you have to create those spaces, which means sometimes slowing stuff down and holding out the outside pressures and the outside voices so that there is a space for students to say in their classrooms what they want to learn and how they might best learn it.
So some of the argument for more standardized curriculum is so that you actually give everyone an equitable opportunity to learn.
Correct.
The important cultural capital, knowledge, and skills that are going to help them all succeed in college. And the concern with student-centered learning is that when you give students so much choice, well then students will revert to a paradigm that is part of disempowered culture, and they will perpetuate inequality based on a limited sense of their own outcomes. So what is the response to that? Why does student-centered learning not pose that danger?
I think it can pose that danger. I think if you have teachers who are not aware of what is of the history and how internalized oppression works and how internalized dominance works. So if you have teachers who perceive themselves, even if it's just in their minds, they don't really know it, it's implicit, that one way, the dominant culture way, is superior. And if you have students or families or teachers who perceive other ways, non-dominant ways, as being less than, then when you turn a curriculum over to students and to teachers to just kind of define and create, that internalized dominance and that internalized oppression can come out in ugly ways and in low expectations for themselves and others. So I think the key is when you do student-centered learning to not only be aware of the options for kids and for kids to be aware of their own academic options and the things they will need in career and college. So they have to have a deep understanding of what whatever they want to be successful in, what that's going to require. They also do need to have a background in anti-oppression. I think it should be every teacher and every student should be learning something called equity literacy, which is the ability to see and understand and then to respond to and redress oppression and inequity in their midst. If you have that understanding of anti-oppression and how it's functioning in society, then you can speak back to low expectations, even in student-centered learning. So when a kid is limiting him or herself or thinking, just maybe self-limiting, there can be a conversation about that and where it's coming from so that those patterns aren't repeated.
Amber, you talked about how teachers need to know their history. Can you talk a little bit about the history of student-centered learning and about your work understanding how cultural competency and equity literacy has and has not been present in student-centered learning?
I mean, I'm not sure if I can talk a lot about the history of student-centered learning. I just know that when I came on the scene in, I think it was like 2003, and really started student-centered learning that was very intense, following the passions and interests of kids, I started reading the work of Nell Noddings, Eleanor Duckworth, and John Dewey, and understanding that we need to follow kids' passions and interests and make their learning relevant to them, give them choices, hear their voice in what they want to learn and how they want to learn it. But then when I started my work in my PhD, I started to understand that that sometimes is a dominant culture view of student-centered learning, meaning I was working with students who are targeted and oppressed, students of color and low socioeconomic status. And what I was asking them for all the time was, what were they interested in? What is your passion? What role do you have in your family? These very surface level understandings of who they are, so I could help them create their projects and follow their passions in my class. That's the form of student-centered learning. And what I started to learn was that sociocultural factors, so their religion, their race, their ethnicity, their gender identity, their sexuality, their language abilities, their first languages, these are all deeply part of our students. And so to be student-centered means to take into account very intentionally not only passions and interests and things that they like to do, but who they are at a sociocultural level, the oppression they experience and the dominance they experience in society. So I think now my understanding is beyond the Nell Noddings understanding, which is about passions and interests and academic needs and academic strengths or multiple intelligence strengths. It goes beyond that. It goes down to sociocultural identity and helping them deal with the targeting and the oppression and the dominance that they face. And that's what I incorporate into student-centered learning now, or I help them and help myself take that into account.
Can you give some examples of what that looks like in a classroom?
In a project-based learning classroom, we do teach concepts to help students in projects. So we teach the project process. We teach a lot of research skills so that kids can follow their interests and passions. But what I would also teach are things like the cycle of liberation, the cycle of socialization, transformative resistance. So we teach frameworks of research. We teach frameworks of project building and inquiry. I would also teach frameworks around oppression and dominance and how it happens and functions in our society and transformation. So that then when we are talking about projects and we are exploring interests and we are developing things, we can talk about their identity and how it's impacting that question. So for example, I have a student who identifies as Latina and her first language is neither Spanish nor English. She has a mix and she talks about that. And she was really interested in studying child abuse. She read A Child Called It, and she just was floored by that book and wanted to explore child abuse and maybe have an impact in society on it. We started to read about child abuse and have all of those resources and interviewing social workers. But we also started to look at child abuse in her community and in her being a Latina, how it functions in communities that experience poverty or living in poverty. We talked about how important it was for her to have resources if she was going to create resources for communities, the language, to make sure they were in both languages, and also for people who aren't literate. So we just started to explore those aspects of how her identity impacts her idea for her project and where oppression is functioning in child abuse and where dominance is functioning in. And we just started to ask those questions. Those questions couldn't have been asked if some frameworks were not laid at the same time as project building frameworks were laid and research building frameworks were laid. So it's just great questions that I could then ask, and she understood those questions and could explore them if she wanted to or if she felt they were relevant.
Amber, for educators who like the sound of what you're talking about but really need to learn more about equity literacy, where should they go?
So Paul Gorski, so Gorski, has a great website at change.org, and all of his publications are there, including some books on equity literacy. I think if you search transformative resistance, you'll find the work Solorzano Delgado Bernal, and it's a framework. You can also just Google cycle of liberation, cycle of socialization, and then the two terms I keep using, internalized dominance and internalized oppression, to understand some of these concepts. I think if you just start looking at some of these definitions and exploring them, but Paul Gorski is a great resource for understanding equity literacy as a concept. And then he links to lots of resources on those topics.
And for people who want to learn more about your work, where should they go?
AmberKKim.com. And I also have resources up. I use lots of videos and have videos that can help educators understand some of these concepts and also student-centered learning.
Amber, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you so much for listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. Now, there are so many different ways for you to connect with us and to keep the conversation going. First, check out studentcenteredlearning.podomatic.com and click the follow button. You'll get an email update when new episodes are published. You can also check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/studentcenteredlearningpodcast. Here you can leave a comment on the episode you just heard, ask a question, or ask for some more resources. Subscribe to us on iTunes, and you'll get us in your podcast feed through the podcast app. We're also on Stitcher, and we look forward to hearing from you and keeping the conversation going.